IT businesses in Sacramento, California.
From somewhere deep in the cloud and the corners of the earth, this is the Killing It Podcast, with a focus on helping you make sense and dollars of all things IT, with your hosts, Dave Sobel, Ryan Morris, and Carl Polachuk.
Welcome to episode 62 of the Killing It Podcast. I'm Carl. I'm joined by Ryan and Dave. We're all at home, as usual.
as is now the norm.
Where we have been for months and months. But there's a light at the end of the tunnel.
So. Hey, I had a really nice long weekend. Like, we actively took a whole staycation approach to it. We all committed to, Sharon and I committed to being offline, so not looking at email, not doing any work kind of stuff. And we were outside a lot. We went for a drive. Like, we made a real effort to be on staycation. We even played an online scavenger hunt, like with like that you could all do at home with like with an app and stuff like that. Just doing silly stuff.
Find your living room. Go find a book.
Well, see, that's the thing, right? If you have an actual plan, it's amazing how much more entertaining being local is. Just sitting and staring out the window and waiting for something interesting to happen, probably not a good strategy. I will agree with you. We had a great weekend here. Spoiled rotten on the fantastic weather in the Pacific Northwest, at least relative to what we usually get in the spring. And I went to the out. I swung golf clubs. It was like I socially distanced and I swung golf clubs. And if you know how I play golf, my definition of a successful day is when you come back with the same number of balls that you went out with. And irrespective of your score, the question is, how many golf balls did you lose? And I came back net minus one this time. That's not because I only lost one. It's because I found one fewer than the ones that I lost.
But you know what? All have been yours. But
There was a time in the middle of that day that I just breathed deep through my nose and out through my mouth, and I said, man, this is a massively fantastic day. So my expectations have adjusted.
It can't all be attitude. You know, it's all about the, as Carl always focuses on in his other endeavors.
Cool. All right. Well, let's do this endeavor. So we actually have kind of a, at least one theme that sort of wanders its way through three topics today, and that is education. So Ryan sent around a, I don't know how we're going to distribute this, but a
PDF. Well, especially because the article's gone now. So, Ryan, why do you do the reaction? I'll do the summary here. So there's this article by an Adobe designer. Now, to be fair, it's a private blog content that was on their own. So this isn't representing Adobe. This is just a designer speaking about the design of Google Classroom. Now that, of course, this being at home, being able to being forced to do education online, had seen the technology used by students and was really commenting on how the choices around space and how they're designed really tell a lot about the values and who's emphasized in the equation. And what really stuck out to me when I read the article was talking about how essentially minimalist Google Classroom is, how it's not a particularly rich tool, it's not particularly user-friendly, it's just very utilitarian. And the author makes comparisons to, well, that's the way we also build schools. Like, we build schools as brick buildings that's concrete and boring, whereas if you think about your work environment, you know, both the tools we use online as well as the physical spaces, the physical spaces are plush and comfortable and colorful, and so are work environments. So it's a really interesting long read. We'll find a way, maybe we'll have to just distribute the PDF in a link, but you know, that was what started the thinking. Right? I know you had some thoughts on this one.
Yeah, see, so I have like a million opinions about this because I am both professionally engaged in the business of selling technology solutions to the K-12 and higher ed marketplaces, and because I am personally fascinated by the advancements and the capabilities in not just classroom technologies, but STEM and STEAM type applications, maker spaces, laboratory, 3D printing in the school environment. I have seen and experienced firsthand some things that are being done in public school environments on limited budgets in a perfectly reasonable way. the schools can be radically technologically advanced, but as we all know, they are not all that way, and they are not all necessarily wanting to go that way, because there's a certain generation of leadership that just says, sit in a classroom in straight rows, face the front, we're going to draw some things on a whiteboard, and that's the industrial model of education that we want to use. One of the things I was reading just yesterday said that just in the state of California, the digital divide is getting smaller. Something like only 4% of the students in California do not have some sort of access to a computing device with internet connectivity such that they can go back and forth. But if you were to try to close that gap just in the state of California, a device, a couple of $100 on a Chromebook, right? A Wi-Fi hotspot, which is not expensive. It's just the consumption on data on a subscription plan there. Just to solve that 4% gap in just the state of California would cost more than $500 million. A, phenomenal opportunity. B, okay, that's a problem. But here's where my brain really kicked into gear, because what this guy said, and I thought it was absolutely fascinating to see it laid out in that definition of spaces and where what you think is actually important. I have used and been involved in the deployment of Google Classroom. It's trash. It is old fashioned. It is like barely like a turn of the century blogging type of a platform. It's only that good. And the killer point was, it's not like Google doesn't care about education. It's not like they don't make a gajillion dollars selling Chromebooks into the education market, where they've established their platform as a veritable industry standard. It's not like they don't have Google Docs and the G Suite and all of the things that they do with special pricing and availability for the education marketplace. They're a massive, well-funded organization that has demonstrated that they care about the education marketplace. And yet, that piece of software is outdated, it's non-functional, it is just not capable. I take a look at that and I say, let's not wait for the vendors. Let's not wait for a magic solution from one central nationwide organization. Bring it down to the channel and say, what can you do in your school, in your classrooms, to make it better?
So I have to say, you know, a piece of this comes from, you know, when we're up here in the world of high tech, to look at something lower tech, it's sort of like, you know, there's a saying in Washington, D.C. among the congressmen, where you stand depends on where you sit, right? if you stand in a world of high technology, then you want this amazing glitz and graphics and all this other stuff. But forget California, 25% of America doesn't have high-speed internet. So yes. When you say, all right, so let's take this out to the middle of freaking nowhere where there's nothing but, you know, open space and 3 meg connectivity, you're not going to be pumping, 4K video to classrooms. It's just not going to happen. So you have to be realistic about what you want. In some ways, the biggest challenge with technology is to say, how can we get the most out of a minimalist environment? And in some ways, that's what Google is doing, because they, to be honest, if they wanted to, they could buy WordPerfect and compete with Microsoft and put money into it and create a suite that is absolutely rocking. But they're smart enough to know not to do that.
I want to challenge a little bit of that thinking, though, because there's a difference between design choices about simplicity versus function, the way the focus of the function. What I took away from the article was less about how pretty it was, but more about the way who the functionality is focused on. The designer made a big point about talking about that it appeared that Google Classroom was much more about the administrators being able to check boxes than thinking about the user, i.e. the student, and how the student worked with the technology. I don't necessarily need the tech to be flashy or have a crazy UI, but what I need it to be is functional. I need it to be focused on me as the user that is implementing it, then using it, and leveraging it. And that was, for me, the important takeaway. Yeah,
I think that is a tremendous point. Make it student-centric, not assignment-centric,
yeah.
And you might go a long way. I think the other side of it, though, is
students like don't make the budgeting decisions.
Yeah, that's true. But see, I think one of the important points is, I say this in many different contexts, want to precedes can do, right? If a student wants to use that application, they will figure it out. If it's ugly, if it's boring, if it's clunky, if it's not easy to use, they won't. And it doesn't matter what it's intended to accomplish. But Carl, I think you nailed it on the head. As we're talking through it, I think you just found the solution. It's not a national solution. It's not one Google thing. It is local. It is individualized to a district based on what the technology connectivity is in that local area, how their teachers teach, what their students are like, and what kind of resources they have. Holy crap, that sounds like a channel business.
Well, I think I hope somebody makes money off this idea.
Yes.
But if
it's only 500 million, like, we can just raise our gas tax by a quarter of a penny and we're golden.
Solved. But actually, you brought something up that I'm going to use, that I'm going to throw to Carl to set the groundwork of. You know, you mentioned the expense of like a Chromebook or something simple. Carl, I want to throw it to you here to kind of give the context around what you're thinking about, what HP is up to, and some of that stuff to lay down the next part.
Thank you. So a lot of people know I work with an organization called AIM, Agape International Missions, to fight sex trafficking in Cambodia and other places. And so part of what we're doing is trying to put together an advisory panel of people to help them with technology, right? And there's many, many layers, because there's the technology inside the NGO itself. There's the technology of dealing with the students, trying to figure out how to put technology into classrooms, and then eventually training programs and getting the technology much more broadly adopted. So one of the most fundamental challenges is that you don't have connectivity and you don't have money and you can't go to the country of Cambodia or anywhere else at the low end of the scale and say, you all need $1,500 desktop machines. It's not happening, right? So HP has designed a program, we're going to put some links down below, but called HP Refresh, and you can just Google HP Refresh and you'll find it. Basically, they're looking at the 1.5 billion students in the world who don't have computers and saying, all right, how can we get them technology? And let's just start out with the assumption it's not going to be the high end.
Right.
You are not distributing brand new high-end computers. So what they've done is they've created this program, HP Refresh. You can go there right now, download their program. When you install it, it writes to a 4 gig flash drive and creates a bootable flash USB key that you then stick into any old computer. And it does a military wipe. It does 4 wipes of the hard drive and then images a Chromebook with a Zoom agent on it. So it's, again, it's like any piece of junk you got sitting around. Actually, right behind me, I have 2 of them that I built over the weekend. Took about 4 hours each. But basically, you put the USB key in, you hit next, 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 and when you're done, you have a Chromebook. And now the next challenge is, I actually had a meeting with some folks from AIM yesterday. So if we send desktops, they take electricity, they need monitors, right? If we send laptops, almost every used laptop you find, what's the one thing you know about it? The battery is dead.
Right.
Right. So there's still challenges, but it's a huge step in the right direction. And it really points towards, you know, how much you can do with just a little bit of technology to make big advancements. And to be honest, HP's program, they're doing it in other countries, but they're also heavily focused in the United States.
Well, and it makes sense. What, again, one in four Americans don't have high-speed internet access. There is certainly an opportunity to provide there. And I, you know, I mean, I'm making a pretty strong argument, I think, these days for the idea of the internet as utility. That it need, we need to make sure that it is available to everyone. This is a really interesting, you know, redeployment of technology, recycle of technology that allows, because I mean, I've always looked and said, you know, the reason I don't like getting involved in donated computers is because they're always garbage and you can't do anything with them. In this environment, if you're wiping them and creating that sort of lockdown managed environment, like a Chromebook, it's like, okay, that actually has real value. And I can see lots of scenarios where that just makes sense. It just gets somebody online, provides the basic connectivity that's required, and we can use that baseline to start delivering services on top of that.
Yep. See, and see, then you take it to another level. I think what's important about this is they're being creative. They didn't just look at a product roadmap and go next and next and next and what's the latest and the greatest. They said, think about it from the scenario and the use case and work backwards to what's available. Well, we're not trying to get the best computer to them. We're trying to figure out how can you solve a problem by using what is available. NGOs around the world, whether it's in water, construction, or education, are notorious for doing that. Like going into an environment and saying, well, we have no equipment, we have nothing, but we've got a tree and we've got some wind and we figured out a way to make a functional kitchen, right? Okay. Being creative like that is the definition of innovation, and it ought to be understood that innovation is not always up and to the right. It's not always bigger, better, faster, stronger. Sometimes it's more usable, right? If you think of that in the context of the innovator's dilemma, right? If you can picture that disruptive curve in your mind about, you know, the time when you will pay more to get more. And then there's another time in the market where everything that's available is more than good enough. And you're not concerned about power. You're concerned about usability. A, that's where we are in the computing endpoint device. B, that's what it needs to be in the world of far-flung audiences without high-speed connectivity. Don't wish for a better computer. Innovate a new solution that can actually bring computing to the people as they are with the resources that they have. I don't know if it's the only solution, right? The Intel guys, a couple of years ago, they came out with the Nook, the next unit of computing, right? And we've done a number of solutions where just the Nook is a computer and all I need is a monitor and a keyboard and it does everything on board. HP's is an even lighter weight approach to doing that. That's fascinating. I love to see that kind of
innovation. The other thing that's cool about it is they're not responsible for what's inside the Chrome operating system or whether Zoom has this update or that update. It's sort of like we have enough of a framework that it's we can support what we do. And then let Google update Chrome, let Zoom update Zoom, you know. And so the other thing is that different perspectives add functionality just because of the, everybody comes from a different way of looking at the world. So we, Jeff Ponce and I, you know, we went to Cambodia, we looked around, we met the people, we know who's in charge of their technology, shook his hand, we, you know, on and on and on. And we had all these ideas. Then we met with the folks from AIM and we're talking about this program and they said, wow. So it's completely impractical to give a laptop to all of these kids to take home where they don't have electricity or running water. But what about a kiosk system where them and their parents could get email accounts and just come to the school and sign on and check their email? And I'm like, well, that's genius. Why didn't we think of that? Because we come from a world where everybody's got a laptop. Everybody's got a computer. So if you just get rid of that assumption, lots of other possibilities are out there.
Amazing how tight that example compares to our first topic. Right?
Right.
Maybe the classroom doesn't have all the tools they need. Figure it out. Be an innovator.
Right. And be creative. And I think, you know, what's interesting on this is that, you know, we talk about the place innovation can happen. It can happen at a solution provider level. Like it doesn't necessarily, you know, it doesn't, you made the point, you don't have to wait on the vendors. Find the requirements, dream up a new solution, and then find the partners to build it with, because that's going to open up the opportunity. I think there's, you know, I mean, if I rephrase it and say, look, 1 in 4 potential customers don't have the tools to get engaged, how would you like to expand the market?
Right.
That becomes, you know, much, much more different conversation.
The other thing is, and this is true with Tech Girls, and this is true with all of the robotics competitions and all of these things where we have STEM programs for young people. Once you have a program, let's say for 50 people, one of these kids is going to have that spark, ignite something in their brain, and then they're just going to start all kinds of new opportunities. They will figure stuff out that you and I could never think of, because we don't live in that environment and we don't have their limitations as well as their resources.
Exactly. So it's, you know, so, and you don't have to necessarily find that everyone is going to do it. You have to find the, you know, you're going to know you've expanded the market and stuff is going to come out of it because of that.
True enough. So oddly enough, we want to transition this conversation into our weekly life after the pandemic and talk about, what do these things mean for classrooms and education and technology after the pandemic? Because one of the comments I think that I've heard recently is that the digital divide is getting wider, not narrower. And so maybe California is doing okay. You know, on the other hand, the world as a whole, I think that digital divide got a lot wider during the pandemic. So the question is, how do we stitch it back together? Because there are some things you have to admit, you know, 5G is never coming to the great hinterlands of the United States, let alone China, Russia, you know, name any country with arid spaces.
Yeah, you know, so I pause there and say, like, I don't like saying never, because that's too open-ended, especially because my instant thought is, well, okay, maybe 5G doesn't roll out first, but 4G did get, well, we've got pretty great coverage. And as that technology continues to be cheaper, it will continue to roll out and fill in the gaps at some level. I look and say, like, I'm not so sure I want to say never. I'm just saying, will it happen fast? I'm not convinced of that. But, you know, I do think, you know, this is, and I'm going to put my little regulation kind of hat again, this is what governments and society are for. I'm not going to go too political in this statement, but I'm going to observe, look, we're having a debate over the Postal Service right now. You know, that's a government service that most Americans enjoy, right? We all believe in the Post. It's one of the most trusted brands.
I enjoy it more now than I did 3 months ago.
Right, exactly. One of the values that is in that organization is that we've said that by constitutional decree, it will deliver to all Americans, right? So it is imposing some rules on the market, whereas a UPS or a FedEx don't have to supply everywhere because they're completely free market. We observe that UPS and FedEx and Amazon all use the Postal Service for their last mile delivery. This is one of those areas where we collectively can decide that we're going to put some rules in place to provide, again, why I think utility for, you know, I think connectivity is a utility, is I think there's value in supplying that to everyone, because then it opens up the additional
sub-level. I wasn't saying that there wouldn't be usable broadband.
Well, but what I'm
the specific technology of 5G.
What I'm observing,
antennas in the world.
I think we're completely in agreement. What I'm observing is that we, as society, may say we want to open up more possibilities for commerce by doing some regulation here, by saying, like, we value this enough that it has to be to everyone. The same reason we want to give everyone clean water, we want to give everyone some level of connectivity so that we have the marketplace.
Well, and the reason that that's an important part of the conversation is, if you think about the classroom beyond the pandemic, a fundamental assumption is connectivity. If you do not have the ability to send and receive files of whatever file size and type, if you can't connect, you can't learn from a distance. That's a baseline, right? So I think there needs to be a global, if not a national, effort to make sure that people can plug in. Then you need devices. Then you need content on those devices. Then you need to have learning plans and curriculum and actually ways to teach kids, which, by the way, we've all learned in this process. If you have kids at home, you know, like my niece's not an at-home digital learner. My nephew is thriving in this at-home digital learning process. That's because that's who they are, not because it is or is not a valid teaching model. But if you think of this stack, you get to the top and then it goes, oh, by the way, we need teachers who know how to teach remotely. And by the way, get the respect and the support and the resources they need to not just run one learning plan, but to run 5 or 6 hybrid learning plans to meet connectivity variations and learning styles and the advancements of curriculum that they're teaching. It's nifty to be able to say, cool, everybody's got a device. Okay, but can you send anything through it? That's important. Is there anything on it that you would be interested in using? And if it's Google Classroom, probably not. But Google Classroom isn't an application. It's an environment. It's a collaboration tool, right? Then you need applications. Then you need curriculum plans, content, calendars, teaching programs.
And it goes beyond schools because you need broadband to connect to your bank.
Yeah.
To pay your employees through, you know, wire transfer to, you know, to do business, to take money. So it's not just the schools, it's all of commerce needs to be connected.
Yep.
You know, just while you were talking, I was thinking about Amy Babinchak was telling me in Michigan, in the middle of all of this, in around where she is, the school district has sent out their school buses wired for Wi-Fi and park them next to libraries and other places so that people can come and sit in their cars and do their homework because they don't have Wi-Fi at home.
Yeah, it's a, again, idea. Be creative. You know, don't worry about whether or not it's perfect. Start where you are, use what you have, do what you can. I think this is the reason why today is dedicated to this topic through all three of our subjects. This is not optional. Like figuring out how to do education beyond this disruption, it kind of is essential for the functioning of our society today and tomorrow into the future. If we can't figure out how to educate kids, I mean, there was an article recently in USA Today, a survey that they and Ipsos did with parents and teachers asking them, you know, is it working? Are the students falling behind? Do we think they're falling so far behind that they cannot catch up? And there are wildly divergent ideas between parents and teachers, as you can imagine. But ultimately, what they're saying is there's an entire generation of kids from K through 12 right now who may not know the stuff they need to know in 5 years. I think we're all about to pay a price for that, and it would behoove every one of us to put on our brainstorming caps and say, all right, technology professional, what can you do to make this better in your town, if not everywhere?
Well, and I'll make that concrete in two ways. I'll say that because I immediately see there's two instant opportunities. The first would be, look, there's a commercial opportunity here, everybody. Like there's, right. They need these services, they need these skills, they will be consuming it. It is a commercial service that you can sell. There's also the expertise in your community that you can offer up as well. So, you know, if you are a parent, if you are engaged with the school system, if you are a volunteer, they need that expertise. They are looking for that expertise. You can do it at that level. You can do it at a governmental level, right? You know, where you can get it. This is where you can get involved and, you know, run for something, run for office, run for school board, run for, like, get involved. They need that expertise in the leadership of it, or get involved in local government, or whatever that is. There are both types of opportunity, both a strict commercial opportunity as well as that societal volunteerism opportunity. And I'll throw both of those out to say, like, you know, you can do those. We need the expertise.
Well, and every school district has or should have an advisory panel about technology. And, you know, if you're in the business, you kind of automatically get to, like, volunteer for that, and they'll say yes.
Right. And by the way, it's great for everybody, and it's also a great business development tool too.
You can go online. There is a website, and if you want to know, let me know. There's a website that you can go to where all of the district's technology plans for this year and next year are available for download to you and me and anybody else who wants to go see it. What have they budgeted? What do they own? What's their platform? What have they planned for refresh and expansion? If that's not just a roadmap to the riches of the future, I don't know what it is. But
the other thing that's really interesting about technology and schools is that at one hand, they have a ton of money and it's all, you know, high end, blah, blah, blah. And on the other hand, you know, at the street level, individual teachers have nothing. They have no budget. They might, they need simple, tiny little things that can make their life easier. And so you could actually get involved at both levels.
At both levels.
All righty then. Any other comments before we finish it all up?
I think we had quite the educational day.
There we go.
We were remiss if I did not make the pun.
Yeah, and by the way, my closing comment is if you're still one of those people who's like, ew, Chromebook, you might want to take a step into the 21st century.
Well, pull from HP, build your Chromebook, and you know, browse to the internet and see if you like it.
Practically a whole other topic there that we can do, that I have so many rants on.
But for now, that will do it for episode 62 of the Killing It
Podcast.
Thanks for tuning in to the Killing It Podcast. Please share with your friends and tell everyone to subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, and all the podcast places. Join us next week and help us keep killing it in the technology business.